Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 5 of Cinemental.
Now, this I can do.
I can't compete with you physically, and you're no match for my brains.
I don't give a crap if you covered yourself in peanut butter and had a 15-hooker gangbang.
I'm Steve Hobicki, and as usual, I'm joined by my co-host, Hassan Godwin, and Lathan Conger III. Good evening, guys.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I am Juan Sanchez Villalobos Ramirez.
Sorry.
how's your week, all right? Anything exciting?
No, and that's what makes it good.
Okay. Fair enough.
That's I like good. A chill week. It's been pretty quiet. I've been being able to get a handle on some things, concentrate on some other things. So, this one's not so bad. This one's going well. Thank you.
Good.
I would say this is the week I realized I'm missing seeing movies in the summer, and it kind of hit me this week. So,
it's June. This is the monster month for movies.
If you'd like, Latham, I can. I have an extra projector I can send you. You can show some movies on the side of your house.
That would be great. Or I could use the bank downtown because I don't think anyone's in there either.
So. Oh my god!
They used to show movies on it too in downtown Palatine. But now it's just begging to be used so we could do something in a large form movie format. But I'm missing it right now.
All right. So then I guess we'll have some news that gives us fits.
Move!
I love that sound bit that we have. My main news bit that gave me fits earlier in the week turned out to be a nothing. Turned out to be conflated nonsense. So I'm not even going to mention it. I would, however...
Mystery box. He's in this box now.
Try and look that up, folks. You won't find it.
I would like to take a moment of silence for the passing of the man who was the gopher from Caddyshack.
Oh.
Puppeteer Pat Brimer passed away this week. He was also involved with Team America World Police.
Wow.
But he was the man who operated the gopher on Caddyshack. So.
Oh, that's kind of sad news.
Yeah, it happens. It should come to no shock to anyone that I don't know if either of you have seen this. Hassan, you probably have. The viral pic of the female Captain Kirk that somebody morphed together. Do you guys both see that?
Yep.
There are tons of them.
There's a whole bunch. There's a Kylo one going around with mixed with him and Natalie Portman. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's also Luke as a girl. There's a lot of
Mark there was Hamill. the whole four pack of those. It should come as no shock to no one that Bill Shatner actually commented on his retweet of the picture and comment was, I do me.
That's exactly what he would say.
I love Bill Shatner. So yeah, as it turns out, my only bit of news that sort of surfaced here at the last minute.
Oh, sorry. The man's a national treasure.
Right? He is. Yeah, he certainly is.
All right. Okay. That's a 90. So he's almost 90 years old.
I know.
And he's talking about I do me.
I know.
Either of you guys watched any of the new series?
You mean Discovery and...
Or Picard?
I've seen them.
I haven't seen any of them.
Okay. I saw Picard, but I haven't watched...
Discovery.
Discovery or whatever. What's the new one, Hassan?
The new one that's not out yet?
Strange New Worlds?
Yeah. Strange New Worlds. Yeah, that hasn't even... That's I don't even know if they started shooting that one.
Right. Okay. That's the one with Anson Mount, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
But it is being made.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. That's Captain Pike.
And it's another CBS All Access series.
Okay. Yeah, I wouldn't say, I mean, you know, the whole, the Star Trek universe is, it's kind of related to the other news bit I was going to bring up too. I just, it feels like it's wearing thin at this point. So
the only other piece I have, so apparently a picture surfaced that was taken. I don't know when the picture was taken. Not like, it wasn't like taken yesterday, obviously, because there's no fucking writer's rooms open right now. But it was the writer's room for the show Killing Eve. You guys know the show?
Oh.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So there was an article about how they were being blasted over this picture, which, again, the picture was old. You know, it's another case of old news being dug up and repurposed. But they were being blasted because there were no persons of color in the writing room of Killing Eve. I'm just, you know, I'm at a point where so much of what's happening right now, and like the instant demonization, very nearly anybody
or anything.
Yes. Yes. And especially police is really, really starting to bother me a lot. A good friend of ours is a police chief in a town north of Chicago. You know, when I see stuff like this, I know the town that he's in isn't necessarily a hotbed of activity of that nature, but it still bothers me because this is one of our best and oldest friends. And I just feel that, you know, there's been so much good that's been done over the years when it comes to the face and the kind of the public face of the police department in general. And I certainly don't mean to get soapboxy here, but this has kind of led into a thing that just bugs me. And to see it all completely go by the wayside and torn down and destroyed over this and what's going on right now because of the few idiots that have managed to worm their way into some departments, it really bothers me. Now, I don't know if either of you two feel the same way. I mean, I'm sure you guys have your own stand on it. That's my piece.
Well, I would say, I agree with you. I think some of it has to do with the fact that we exist in a social media world now, and anything brought to light is suddenly under the biggest microscope of all time. So it's frustrating when a cause gets brought forward, an important cause, and then it gets applied correctly to some things and incorrectly to other things. And if you're just going to go around in any, you know, corner of entertainment and see a picture and say, wait a minute, there's not enough so-and-sos in this picture, that needs to be corrected. You're really, I think you're betraying your cause. I think you're trying too hard, and you're making everything too, you know, for lack of a better term, black and white. And there's nuances and levels to everything. So to blankly say, here's a writer's room, there's no black people in this writer's room. I mean, it's just, I mean, how many shows are there? What are the stories of every person that ended up in that writer's room? How are they brought together? I mean, you're dismissing much empirical evidence as to how this creative project came together. And that's when I see something like that, that really bothers me. I'll leave it there. I know how you feel, Steve, and I feel the same way. And we know people who are not bad police officers and will never be bad police officers, but everything now is like a tendril that sticks into that issue. So to get it to the writing room of Killing Eve is, to me, it's just a head shaker on my end.
I agree. My biggest problem with the discussion, well, not this discussion, but the discussion in general, is that when it gets taken too far, and it often does get taken too far, it seems to be an excuse to rebound all the way back to not necessary. So there's middle ground, and nobody ever goes for the middle. Like there's never a middle ground. So it's like, well, there's not any diversity in this writing room, right? So it's like, maybe we want to get some other voices in this room. Like maybe that's a reasonable attitude so that we can have a more comprehensive, whatever the product's going to be. And then someone comes along and accuses you of not having enough diverse voices in here. And then so now everybody wants to cancel you on behalf of that. Now the entire situation now retracts And now there's no either the show gets canceled and no, there's no writing room whatsoever, so nobody gets any material, or there's no, they close ranks and then they do a hiring freeze and no one's getting in and no one's getting out. So it's a little overwrought. It's hard, I think, to criticize from my perspective, the call for more inclusiveness. However, I do understand how that becomes more the focal point than the actual material than anybody is doing. So, like, you know, when you get a complaint about there's not enough black people in Dunkirk, that's a problem, right? Or in Vikings, you know, where are the, you know, where's the diversity, you know? And so sometimes, a lot of times, and most of these people who complain about this stuff are just, they're LARPers, you know, they're outrage peddlers, you know, nobody really cares about any of these causes. Anybody who actually wants these things to happen isn't going to tweet about it. They're going to write a letter. They're going to try to do something about it. So all this stuff gets sensationalized to the point where it doesn't serve anyone.
And the thing, like the point of bringing up something like Vikings, you know, obviously, yes, it's a little more difficult to inject persons of color into the Norse history.
Freeman can't do a walk on.
Right. You know, as much as,
he did that with Robin Hood, yeah, as a matter of fact, right. You know, and it was like, okay,
well, right. You know, they managed to throw a Moorish pict in there or more. And it's like, okay, yeah. Well, all right, Bob. Yeah. But you know, the thing is, you know, and I hate getting into this debate. I mean, I don't mind talking to you guys about it because I know both of you guys, and I know that we can have a discussion about it, and I'm not worried about offending either one of you. And I know that both of you know me and know how I think and feel about most things, know what kind of a person I am. But, you know, the whole thing of, you know, in this particular case, whatever happened to you hire the best person for the job? You know, and the thing is they look at a snapshot of a third year of a writing room on the third year of a TV show. It wasn't posted next to pictures of the second year and the first year where there may have been persons of color in that writing room. So it wasn't like they're like, Jesus Christ, they fired all the black people out of that writing room.
Yeah.
And it's like, maybe this writing room has been together since the beginning. And these people have all been working together for the last three seasons, and they're the reason the show is successful and well done.
Well, yeah, of course.
And you're going to be like, well, you know what? We better hire a Latino because, you know, otherwise we're going to get jacked up on social media.
It's moronic. It's ridiculous. And just like anything on the internet, there's only one way to defeat it, guys. And what is that?
Well,
you ignore it and you move on. That's it.
Yeah, I know.
And it doesn't change the fact that it gave you fits. And
yeah,
it's
right. So who wants to go?
Yeah, mine doesn't add up in comparison to yours. I'm just pissed that they pushed Godzilla back.
How pissed is Godzilla?
Yeah.
They, and in the last movie they blew up his apartment. Now they're slowing his movie down. Right.
Is this the third one?
Yeah. This is a Godzilla versus King.
Oh, that one, right? Is what's her name back? Millie Bobby Brown?
No,
I do not believe so. I think it's going to be. It's one of those anthology things where it's a new cast every movie except for Godzilla
and the Asian guy. Or no, he died in the second one too.
He died.
Did he?
Yeah, Ken Watanabe sacrificed himself.
Oh, that's right. That's right. He did. And the girl from The Girl Who Sleeps with Fish, she got killed by debris.
That's right.
She got squashed by debris. That was pretty ignominious since she won an Oscar.
I know, right?
Previously.
I think it's hard to, when I talk about the first one, I always tell people like how I didn't even want to go see it. I was so happily surprised at how great it was, pretty much thanks to the director. Gareth Edwards, am I right?
It was
such a nice, fun surprise, like really great stuff. Second one, didn't like it as much as the first one, but visually still fun.
Latham, have you seen Monsters?
It's in my queue. I've had so many people try and not tell me about it. So
Yeah.
Edwards did arguably the only good Disney Star Wars movie.
Yeah.
What was that? Rogue One?
Rogue One. In my opinion.
He really had, I mean, I'm, from what I heard about Monsters, I can't attest to it because I haven't seen it, but his other stuff, what else did he do? Did he do Looper? No.
That's Ryan Johnson. No.
That's Ryan Johnson.
Oh. Can we do a whole episode on that?
Yeah, why not?
Rage building.
I would want to see who's directing the third one.
Mike Dougherty.
Steve, damn it.
What did he do?
Quick on he the did draw.
A movie,
right
he
here.
Did a movie called Trick or Treat. Was his first big. Oh. It was his first big break, and then he's been doing a bunch of other stuff in between. And he did a Krampus, and now he's doing King Kong versus Godzilla.
Okay, that's cool. Days of the. Oh, nice. Okay, yeah, you're right. He hasn't done
a lot.
He did something with the X-Men movies. He must have been a director of photography or something on those. Hassan, let us know what we can do for you. It sounds like you're going to be really. screwed up over this for a while, so
man, I don't know. I'm getting rid of all my rope,
okay,
just in case.
How about if I can get a camera up really, really close to a couple of squirrels fighting? It might look like kaiju.
You got to do it in slow motion, though. You got to slow it all down.
I have to throw in some. I'll have to have my buddy Brian throw some atomic breath on it or something.
Yeah, and then some techno music in the background.
There is a great video I saw today of a guy who built a squirrel. Best analogy is America's Greatest Ninja Warrior course for the squirrel to get to the bird feeder. He has to pass like 6 tests. And he must.
That's awesome.
To get on the first level, it's the only pole that's not greased. So that's the one he climbs. I'll send you guys this video. It's just some people not only have a lot of time on their hands, but they are just niche brilliant.
One thing we do is everybody's got a lot of time.
I mean, this guy went, there is ingenious stuff he put in this thing.
Listen, I was watching videos today of guys who have made these incredible concoctions of basically gluing wooden stick matches together. And making these elaborate constructs out of matches and then lighting them on fire.
Wow. Satisfying after you build it and then burn it.
Oh, dude. Well, they make volcanoes and shit out of it that like make like things that end up shooting flames 12 feet in the air.
That's awesome.
All out of matches and sparklers.
Yeah, that's.
They just take a bunch of matches and then they wrap it around sparklers, like a bundle of like 50 sparklers, and then they just light it on fire. Right. So
better than walking around the supermarket with a fucking mask on.
Walking anywhere with a mask on, really. But
so I'd like to see those videos too.
So what's your bit, Len?
My only one is this. I guess you call it an announcement by the Oscars pushing the. The broadcast for next year back already and saying they're going to make new provisions for new categories and expand the movies. And my tale of the Oscars runs the gamut from when I was a kid, I wanted to be the guy who ended up winning an Oscar. And now last year was the first year where I not only didn't watch it, but didn't care about the results. Didn't look them up the next year. I really have lost interest in that part of Hollywood. And, sure, it's a gauge for some better films, but in the recent years, especially when they expanded it to more than 5 movies for Best Picture, there have been some real three and a 4-star movies that probably shouldn't be Best Picture nominees. And we're in June of 2020. I don't understand why we're talking about this already, besides the fact that they want publicity, considering no one is seeing films in the theater anymore, I'm guessing might be the only reason.
I don't disagree with you necessarily, but I mean, I honestly felt when they expanded the, because back in the old days, there was no limit on, before they limited it to 5 films, it used to be just, there was no limit. They could nominate as many films as they wanted. It generally fell to between 4 and 5, just because that was the way it worked out. When they opened it back up here a few years ago, I kind of got the feeling that it was kind of hearkening to a more inclusionary process and part, you know, like the whole everybody gets a trophy, you know, the participation trophy, you know, where in 90% of the cases now, you know, the nomination is the win. Being able to put nominated for best picture on the poster, on the video, on the DVD package, whatever, that's the win.
Yep, that's what bothers me. That's what I don't like. I don't.
Right.
I mean, it's oversaturation, and you know, I mean, who knows? There's people that think our pandemic is going to lead to the death of movie theaters. I mean, you know, what are we talking about here? As far as, you know, we talked about this, I think, on our other podcast, but it's hard enough to get people to go see some of these nominated films for Best Picture. They're very independent. Oh, yeah. They're very small, and who knows? They might just relent to just releasing them online anyway. I also think it's funny that I think it was 2 years ago that Spielberg made the comments about Netflix movies shouldn't be nominated for Best Picture. And then
it was last fall.
It was last fall? So
it was last year.
Well, either way.
Right before The Irishman got nominated. Yeah,
it was before Scorsese got nominated for The Irishman, and not a peep came from his mouth once that happened. So
yeah, no, he backpedaled pretty quickly on his
let me
clarify my comments a little better. what I actually meant was
hypocrisy from the record. So anyway, it just bothered me to, you know, we're waiting for restaurants to be opening inside, and the progress and process of the pandemic, you know, loosening up the restrictions, and here come the Oscars telling us 10 months from now you're going to see the broadcast. That just, it bothered me, because the Oscars bother me in general. So.
Well, you didn't think it would be the opposite then. If you were bothered by the Oscars, then putting it off and making more provisions, you'd care even less.
No, well, no, I mean, if they said they were going to hide a bomb somewhere in the auditorium.
Don't say the B word.
And blow it up.
Don't say the B word.
What do you say?
Don't say the B word.
Don't say the B word?
Don't just like the signs at the airport, Lay. Don't joke.
Especially on a show with a person named Hassan on the staff.
a bomb pop, okay? A bomb pop, you know, the kind you get from an ice cream cart. They hide it under one of the chairs, and there it melts. And then that celebrity slips when they get up to go to the bathroom, and it's a big tragedy. That's what I meant.
You're okay, Hassan, because it's Hassan and not Al Hassan.
Yeah, and all they have to do is do a quick
try explaining that to the ICE agent who comes here to talk to me.
Do a quick social media search. You'll know who the culprit of these three are easily.
Yeah, right.
So yeah, I didn't. That's all I had, but.
Hopefully next week there'll be more stuff that annoys us. Because I'd rather not talk about current events ever if I can help it. Just because there's no upside. So from there, I think we'll step into our feature film. All right, today's feature film: Rocket Man.
I could hear the whole tune in my head. It was all there. I could see all the notes, and I just had to get it out.
It's a little bit funny, this feeling inside.
What did you say your name was again?
I'm thinking of changing my name to Elton.
So how does it feel to be a star?
It's never gonna last.
Let's just enjoy it while we can.
Don't you want to just sing without this ridiculous paraphernalia?
People don't pay to see Reg Dwight. They pay to see Elton John.
Sorry.
I know.
Directed by Dexter Fletcher, with a running time of 121 minutes. Poster tagline, based on a true fantasy. The life, including early excess and success, of rock and roll legend Elton John, as told via the artist's own songbook. Once again, I believe this was a first-time viewing for Latham U, correct?
Yep, for sure.
Hassan, had you seen it before?
No, I had not.
So it's, well, both of you guys are first-time?
That's correct.
Yeah, so this is another one that I probably watched. This was probably the fourth or fifth time I've seen it. I even watched it once on an airplane. I was going somewhere last year and it happened to be on, and I'm just like, yeah, I'll just throw this on for the just for a few minutes. And I ended up sitting through the whole thing again. Let's start with Hassan. Hassan, what did you think? And I know you enjoyed Bohemian Rhapsody, correct?
I did.
Okay.
I thought this was I definitely thought this was better than Bohemian Rhapsody because it's very stylized. It didn't require a detailed play by play of Elton John's life. It was more of a kind of a pastiche of a little coloring of what his home life was like when he was a child. A little focusing on the fact that he was extremely talented and gifted, and a lot of people figured it out very early. And then, edging into, even though he was highly, ridiculously successful, he was still basically being pimped out, being controlled. So in this format, unlike Bohemian Rhapsody, I enjoyed Bohemian Rhapsody, but I enjoyed that mostly because I knew the band really well. And I knew the material, and it was just really great to see a little bit of insight into the behind the scenes of some albums that I really thought were fantastic. Not being a tremendous Elton John fan, and that's not because I don't like his music, it's just because I never got into his music. It was more of a visceral experience just in general. You can't grow up in the time that we grew up in and not know most of those songs. You can't not, Rocket Man and Sad Songs and a bunch of other, Saturday, but, hearing them in the context of them, explaining his life and, showing how, it's a funny experience because he basically, nothing really bad happened to him other than stuff that he did to himself. So the film very wisely and does a really good job of not necessarily feeling sorry for him, but kind of just showing how he fell down a rabbit hole because he was tremendously mistreated and neglected, by his family, growing up, and he kind of leaned right into his natural gifts that got him somewhere. But of course that wasn't enough. And then he had self-esteem issues and stuff like that. So it was really a sad story. And it was a story that you didn't mind, in my opinion. You didn't mind feeling bad for him because it wasn't a woe is me kind of situation. It was I need to get my act together kind of situation. So it was easier for me to sympathize with him and to identify with him. Because, if he had achieved such a tremendous success and then had this really sad story about how nobody loves me, even on this, it would have probably been hard for me to lock in to that and to identify with it. But since it was very honest about his shortcomings as well as everybody else's, it was a lot easier for me to just see how, relations can get screwed up and how, young people deprived, of certain attentions. I don't think that's the right word, but that's what I'm going to go with right now. Certain kind of attention, certain affections, it can leave a indelible mark on them. And sometimes they could do a lot of really good with it, but sometimes they do a lot of really bad things to themselves. So I thought the film was really beautiful. I thought it was really well done. The music was well placed. The acting is fantastic. I was really surprised by Bryce Dallas Howard as his mother. First of all, I didn't know she was in the movie at all. And she did just a fantastic job. And she's very not, apparently not vain in how bad she looked through that, as the film progressed on. So, yeah, I enjoyed it. I think it was a really good movie. It'd probably be a little difficult for me to watch again because, some of it tugged a couple of strings, but it was a really good experience. I enjoyed it.
Well, I would say I liked it less than both of you. I think it's a good movie. There's a type of movie I see where it's usually a biopic and all the acting is fantastic. And in this movie, it's, no different. Taron Egerton, if that's how you say his name, he's great. Richard Madden's great. All the supporting characters are awesome. I guess the way I see it is, what kind of story do we have here if you take Elton John out of it? And if you take Elton John and his music out of it, it's a really stereotypical rock star story. And I didn't like, here's what I really didn't like. I didn't like the, I don't know if you call it the climactic scene or the cathartic scene or whatever, near the end where he's talking to all the people in his life. I mean, some of these people were, his dad was just rotten. I mean, if how it was portrayed on screen is how it was, he was rotten. And in the therapy scene, he's giving him a pass. And then he's giving this person a pass. And whatever lesson he's talking about learning and forgiving, I didn't buy it. It didn't make me feel emotional. It didn't make me feel anything like he had learned anything. And then for the end, the coda, when they start putting up all the great things Elton John did, giving his money to charity and this and this and this afterwards, that coupled with that scene felt cheap to me. That felt like it was trying to direct our emotions in a certain direction. And I didn't buy it. Like I said, it's a good film. It's well made. The musical sequences are decent. If you like his songs, it's a unique take on them. But, you know, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't Edgerton sing everything in this film?
Yep.
So that was interesting. But in essence, I mean, and he's good, too. He's good. And I know he's gone on stage and sung with Elton John live and stuff like that. But I kind of need to hear the Elton John versions of the songs, or at least Elton John's voice over the arrangements of the songs. It just didn't. I kept waiting for some kind of emotion to hit me, and it never hit me. It just stayed along a stereotypical path with what happened to him in his life and all these people treating him like crap. And I liked Bohemian Rhapsody better than this, because that's the, you know, obviously the nearest musical biopic we've seen to this. That one felt more personal to me a little bit. This, you know, like I said, it was decent. I would probably never watch it again. I think I've got the entire story and wouldn't investigate this unless I was on a plane and it came on, Steve.
So. Yeah, I had, the first time I saw this, and I'd already seen Bohemian Rhapsody, obviously, and I knew five minutes into this movie, I knew I was getting something entirely different. And as good as Bohemian Rhapsody is, I just, compared to this, I think it's dry and lifeless. I think there's so much more life in Rocketman, so much more. I don't want to say entertaining, because I really enjoy Bohemian Rhapsody, and the performances in that movie are on par with anything we see in Rocketman. There are certain things that stand out in this film for me. The last scene of him as a young child, when he's in the bed and his mom tells him to go to bed and turn out the light, and you know he's conducting the orchestra underneath the bed sheet with the flashlight, and as the flashlight pans around, the flashlight lights up different parts of the orchestra. And that's like how he's conducting. And then at the last second, he stands up on the bed and he's got the black jacket on. He's got the little piano and he just hits the piano. It just, all I could think of was Schroeder from the Peanuts at that instant. I was just like, oh my God, they've thrown the Peanuts in here. But it's just amazing. There's a couple of scenes in this movie that are just absolutely hands down stellar.
I think when she tells him that he's never going to be loved correctly when he calls her on the phone.
Yeah, I have a whole thing about that. I have a whole note about it's like if his parents were half as awful as they're portrayed in this film, there can't be any redemption for them.
Yeah,
there just can't be.
I won't go into before you start. I would add to this movie that there were a number of gut punches that I did not see coming, you know? And from what I mean is, like, I don't mean there were, like, twists and turns that I didn't expect. I just didn't expect some of the moments that some of which are you know, like Latham says, are rock star predictable. But I didn't expect some of the moments to be as effective as they were.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, like I said, I thought it was a sad story. I thought it was, you know, it had a great ending, and it's one of the very few that we have about these guys when they're still alive. You know, like Elton John is still alive.
Yeah.
So, like, it ultimately is going to have a happy ending.
You know, when did I'm Still Standing come out? That was what, 89?
Oh, no.
87? 84?
I thought it was 83, wasn't it?
I mean, so this movie essentially only covers his life up until 83.
Yeah, and that's, I might be wrong there. Hold on.
Maybe not far off. It might be 84, 85.
No, I guess it is. Oh, 83. February 3rd, 83.
Okay. All
right. That confused me too, because when they did that towards the end, I'm like, well, that book ends the movie very, very, in a very small, I mean, basically like, what, 20? I mean, besides him being a kid.
Yeah.
You know. As a star, not many years. So,
as one criticism, though, I think they could have given his. I know he's a very prominent part of the movie, but they could have given his Jamie Bell's character, the writer. Oh man, I'm bad with names.
Bernie Taupin,
in real life, yeah. They could have given him a lot more spotlight in the hand he had at some of those. Like almost every one of his hits, you know. Now he was kind of the. He was the angel, you know, on the shoulder, and the conscious.
Only good guy, yeah. He's the only one that didn't screw him over, according to the movie.
Yeah, and I'm sure, you know, just the way the character is kind of rolled out.
Yeah,
but they just could have given him a little more creative credit for what you know, because every hit that Elton had, correct. You know, that guy had a hard hand in it, so. Yeah.
Taupin wrote all. If you go back and you look at the record albums, they're all They're all Elton John, Bernie Taupin, all of them.
Going all the way back to
the beginning.
Wow.
Any song that's not a standard, or that short period of time, I think was only an album or two that he released without Bernie's when he wasn't working with Bernie.
Yeah.
Everything else is Bernie wrote the lyrics.
Wow.
Yeah, so I think they could have done a little more to showcase his creative input. Now, I understand that that might have muddied the water a bit, you know, and it's basically, like I said before, the reason it gets a pass on some of the details is because it's very stylized. So it's supposed to be like kind of a rapid, you know, poetic montage, mostly, of events, you know, of key events. So it does get away with not having done that, you know, I think it would have muddied its purpose if it had done that, but I could have used a little more information about that. That's all.
I think that the way that they established the relationship kind of from the get-go with Bernie, and they sort of, like you said, they sort of placed him throughout as this sort of angelic character. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily feel like you need him there. I feel like it's more important from the storytelling standpoint to focus on all the bad.
Oh, well,
yeah.
Because you know that good side is there, and you know at the end of the day that the good side is essentially what's going to win out.
Yeah. It didn't hurt the movie. The movie is good the way it is.
Yes.
The only thing I would add is if anybody asked me, is there anything you could have used a little more of? That would be it. But it does not mean by any stretch of
more Jamie Bell.
Yes.
Gotcha.
I think they would have balanced it better. I think they did need more of him. The best scene with him in the film and Edgerton is the scene on the rooftop when he goes to kiss him and he tells him, I don't like you like that, but I love you. That was tender and great, and that was the balance. It needed more of that along the way.
That and that hallway scene where he's yelling at him because he's being a complete prick.
Right.
And he's like, and then he comes back, sorry.
He's like, I know.
They never had an argument over however many years. Well, that's an argument in the hallway. Okay, so.
It's not really an argument.
Yeah, that's one guy weathering the other guy being a dick.
And to your point, Latham, about that final scene, I actually have a note about that. That final scene in the rehab, I enjoyed the fact, you know, I took it very differently on all those cases where all those people came out and they held their ground of being that terrible human being that they'd been sort of throughout the film. And I feel like he just says what he needs to say to them and doesn't let them off the hook. I feel like he doesn't release any of them. That's what I like about that scene. I took it the opposite way you did. I looked at it as him just saying, you know what? You're right. And you know what? This is your issue, not mine. And you're going to have to live with that because I'm done.
Yeah, I mean that makes sense.
That's just the way I took it personally.
It felt like he didn't learn anything. But
I looked at it that he had to let them all go so that he could get better.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, you know, preach that you should do that. Just don't hold grudges. Don't, you know, the only way for you to move forward is forget the past. And, you know, that's
right.
That's one healthy way to live.
And I'll tell you guys this. I watched about 3 hours of various press interviews, junket footage, all that kind of stuff for the film that I was able to scramble down on you, mostly on YouTube. And there's a couple of really interesting interviews with Elton John. And I'll tell you, as bad a light as his parents are shown in, an interviewer who is talking to them the morning of the premiere. So Elton hadn't even seen the film yet.
Wow.
He had seen some, you know, he'd seen dailies and rushes and whatnot. So he had seen footage from the film, but he hadn't seen the finished product. And the interviewer asked straight out, were your parents really that bad? Were they, he's like, your parents were awful. He's like, you know, was that what they were really like? And, you know, and he made the point. He says, well, you know, I haven't seen the film, so I don't know exactly how they're portrayed. He's like, I'll say this. He goes, while my parents were together, neither of them were ever happy. And he goes, it wasn't until they split up and found new partners that they were able to achieve any level of their own happiness. And yeah. That was the end of his statement. He said no more, no less. That was it.
And the movie took it further and showed that even after finding their new partners, they were still complete assholes. So, yeah. I mean, I wonder what he thinks now, you know?
Yeah, his mom more came off as resentful or jealous than like a total, like she took care of him. She looked after him.
Grudgingly.
Barely. A terrible mother, and his father should have been, his father, based on the film, was just a shit person, especially that was the toughest scene in the movie for me to watch.
When he goes to visit him with the kids?
Yeah, and he's being so nice to his new kids, I would have decked them. I mean, that's just, that's such a shitty thing to do to your actual first son.
Well, he didn't even consider Elton like his...
Right.
Yeah, you're right.
A real person, you know.
That hurt him.
And both Elton and Bernie maintain that Elton's father never saw him perform live in person. He never came to see him play.
Is he dead?
I would expect so.
Yeah, because
Elton's 70 something.
Yeah.
I would expect that his father and mother are both gone.
Oh, maybe. That old coot in his anger could live for a long time. Mm.
I really liked the bit over the end credits. Where they were showing the shots of Taron Egerton compared to the same essential shots of Elton at the same periods in time and the same similar outfits. I really like that touch.
Yeah.
And I have a note here. It says this film is as much about the Elton John Bernie Taupin relationship as it is about the arc of his own life and the infinite importance of that. We touched on that a little bit already. So circling back to...
Kind of a hard movie to watch, actually. You know, like,
you thought so?
In ways, it was worth it, but in certain ways, it was like, wow, like, you know, there are some emotions that you get from the film that you were kind of not hoping to identify with, like, oh, I know how that feels, you know, or I know how that feels, you know. That's so. It was kind of a cathartic experience. I guess that's another reason I liked it, because I do recognize some of the points that Latham is making about sort of it's sort of a cookie cutter rock star story. I think it has its merit because of the way it's done. It's very wonderfully stylized.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big part of its success is the way it's directed.
Right. But I see your point about, like, and that's kind of the point I was touching on in the very beginning of, because it doesn't really showcase a lot of his struggling to become Elton John, to become a rock star, because it's almost incidental, like, that he just eventually rises through the ranks to the point where he gets, you know, he becomes a best-selling, you know, musician.
Well, I think that was part of the point. I mean, I don't think he had to. That was it. I mean, he basically came out of the box, and once they were able to get his produced work out to the ears of the world, people loved him from the first word.
So that's the danger of a story like this, is because everybody equates success with the struggle. When you show a character who does not necessarily have to struggle to get showcased, and then he's still miserable, it's very dangerous kind of story to that you could lose your audience, that people could not identify with it. But the way they did it, I think the success of it is you just really like Elton John. You know, you just really like Edgerton, you know, in his performance. You like him as a child. You sympathize with his situation at home. And since he's...
Those two kids, they got to play him.
Yeah, that was
unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah, those side especially by side
the middle kid. The middle kid was like...
Yeah.
You know, and in his last scene was his best one, where he transitions into Edgerton.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It really surprised me that... I was kind of with him the whole time, you know, even when he started to act out, you know, even he chose wrong. He made a lot of wrong life choices. He chose the wrong people, right?
Yep.
That's something we all have to deal with. But I still was sympathetic to it. You know, I wasn't like, well, I don't give a shit about you. You're a millionaire. you know, you surround yourself with dicks. Yeah, exactly. But for some reason, because of the way it was done, it was just... It was such a delightful, I think that's the word I was used trying to look for the entire evening, guys. I apologize. It was just done very delightfully so that I could A, identify with his shortcomings, and B, I could kind of be with him even when he was being a dick. And since he has a cathartic moment, since he comes to grips with who he is and his own participation in his misery, it's easier to get on board with him, you know,
yeah,
as opposed to him just
that's for sure.
How come nobody loves me?
Yeah,
I think Hassan just reminded me of a good point too, in reverse of why I didn't like it as much, is besides his music, I don't think Elton John is very interesting. And in his travels from this point in his life to the later point in his life, you know, you've got all his mistakes he makes or whatever, but all the characters around him are more interesting than him, but they're all douchebags or horrible people. So I lost interest in him as a character, you know, still liked his music, liked what they did. But besides that, I didn't find his life that interesting. So I'm focused on these people just treating him like absolute shit. And I think that wore on me as the movie went on. But fortunately, it was directed well, and you know, the musical sequences are great, so I'm kind of bagging on it. I still think it's a good movie. I don't like it as much as
I did.
Yeah. I'll break Latham's review down. It didn't hurt to watch. This did not hurt my eyes.
This did not suck.
As I like to say, a three-star movie I'll probably never watch again. Unless I'm on a plane.
See, now I feel that Requiem for a Dream is a 3.5-star movie that I'll never watch again.
Oh, yeah. Well, we can get I've got a few of those. Who brought up the point of I think Hassan did, about there's some movies that are just, they're great, but they're very difficult to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah, Requiem for a Dream is a perfect one. I think my favorite along those lines is a movie called Affliction with Nick Nolte. Have you guys seen that?
No,
I know the movie. I haven't seen it.
Oh, wow. And then obviously Irreversible is
the number one movie that I think
is great.
I've seen that movie like 12 times. Anybody.
What'd you say?
I said I've seen that movie like 12 times.
Are you seriously?
No.
No. Have you seen it once?
Yes.
Okay.
My stomach still hurts.
I'm a big fan of Gaspar Noé. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
My God. Whose idea was that? That's like the guy who wrote Deliverance. Like, hey, whose idea was this? Like, how do you launch a story like this?
Yeah.
I got an idea. I know what's going to happen. There's going to be a brutal rape, and then we're going to do everything backwards.
That's what you're questioning while you're watching it, is who the fuck came up with this idea? I mean, it's brilliant, but who the fuck thought of this shit?
It's brilliant because it's horrific. I mean, it's actual exploration of horror that, you know, and real life horror, not guy with a knife in your closet horror. Yeah.
Hassan, have you seen a French film called I Stand Alone?
Yeah, that's him too.
Oh, I have not. I don't believe I have. And I don't believe I will. Now that you
if you had watched I Stand Alone and you knew it was the same director going in, I think you'd probably be less surprised. I'll just
or
say
enter the void too.
Enter the void.
Enter the void is
no.
I think Hassan would like that better.
Enter the void. Yeah, Enter the Void is definitely more enjoyable to watch. But yeah, it's
yeah. Well, my first ride was Irreversible, and I'm like, why am I watching? Yep.
I remember where I was when I watched that movie in my living room with Carl. Me and Carl watched that TV, and Carl, me and him were just transfixed. Like, what are we watching?
What's happening to us? Something is physically happening to me while watching. Yeah.
I feel nauseous. Would you mind if I barfed on you?
So just so everyone's aware that this is not the 97 film with Harland Williams, probably best known for his portrayal of the gifted sonar operator from the 96 film Down Periscope, which I may or may not admit is on my guilty pleasures list.
Yeah. Literally no one asked. No one. No one in podcast land on the roller coaster's
ass. So what's funny about this is, so in one of the interviews I was watching of Taron Egerton on Jimmy Kimmel, I think, Jimmy asked him, he goes, you know, there's another movie called Rocket Man. It came out back in the 90s. And Taron's like, what? And he held up a picture of the poster.
Oh, that's classic.
Which I thought was hysterical. So apparently as early as the early 2010s is when Elton John had started to try and put together this project, and he publicly stated that he wanted Justin Timberlake to play him in a film version. What's that?
Super talented guy in many different genres of art.
There's literally nothing he can't do, as far as I'm concerned. He's really a talented guy.
He's really good. Yeah.
So this is the one that absolutely blows my mind. So Tom Hardy was attached to this for 3 years in development.
Did not see that.
And only bowed out eventually, basically because it became made very apparent to him that Elton John wanted whoever was going to play him to actually sing all their own parts. And at that point, he basically got a little nervous and said, I gotta go. I gotta go do Venom.
Yeah. I gotta go make a one-shot cab movie. I can't do this.
Yeah, that's right. Others considered for the role: Daniel Radcliffe and James McAvoy.
Radcliffe, could have done
McAvoy.
It.
McAvoy could do anything.
No, he's a little too common.
Yes.
McAvoy, he's like everywhere. I remember seeing him in Children of Dune. That was the first thing I ever saw him in. And then all of a sudden, he was everywhere on my television. I'm like, Jesus Christ, he's the same guy again.
So we've gone over the fact that Taron did all of his own singing.
Yes.
Wore 53 different pairs of glasses during the film.
Amazing.
Funny side bit about Taron Egerton, apparently for his drama school audition, he sang your song.
Huh. So he had experience already.
Right. He also worked on one of Dexter Fletcher's previous films, Eddie the Eagle, biopic about the ski jumper.
Right.
So they had an existing relationship. You know, and I'll get into this more, but there's there's a triangle between Dexter Fletcher, Matthew Vaughn, and Taron Egerton that kind of ties together a whole bunch of films.
Right.
What I found most interesting out about Dexter Fletcher was this is his fourth directing credit. He's directed four films, not counting the next Sherlock Holmes film and the uncredited
Bohemian Rhapsody.
Finishing Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah. Right.
We'll probably really never get a good audit on what he actually did.
Yeah, it's already agreed with for credit. So,
well, no one will ever really, I mean, other than people who were there, will never really understand or know
right
how much he actually did as part of that, you know. Right. But it's, you know, it, you know, he was actually up for the job of directing Bohemian Rhapsody before Bryan Singer got it. So it's not surprising that they ended up calling him in to kind of wrap things up, as it turned out, because they already had his number in the Rolodex. So
Bryan Singer. We had to do a whole special on him one day too.
Oh, well, pick one of his movies and then watch it and then go through his filmography and go to town.
Yeah. So Jamie Bell starred in Billy Elliot back in 2000. And when that movie was adapted to a stage play, which apparently Elton John pitched to the director at Cannes at its premiere, Elton John wrote all the music for the stage play Billy Elliot. So actually, Jamie Bell had met Elton John before this whole thing had gone off. Bryce Dallas Howard, only 8 years older than Taron Egerton.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
She did not mind making herself. That was impressive. Yeah. You know?
Did she put weight on for that role?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
She was in Charlize Theron territory in how she recreated herself.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing. And she can go in and out.
I only assume she's gonna bounce right back for Jurassic.
Yeah, but I mean,
she's real skinny in the Black Mirror episode she's in too, which was not directly before this, but not too far before.
Well, if you watch her on the director's whatever thing for The Mandalorian, she's of her typical size. Yes, I don't know how to.
Is she in The Mandalorian?
She's a director. She directed one of the episodes.
Oh, okay.
That's right.
Wait a minute. Was it one of the ones where...
I don't remember which one she did.
Well, no, I think it was the one where the little Yoda guy was the most important thing in the episode.
Yes, that one.
I'm sorry. I'll just be quiet right now. I'm just going to be quiet. Sorry. Tangential.
So the interesting thing I found out about Dexter Fletcher, this was only his fourth director's credit.
Yeah, I saw that too.
But he has 108 acting credits.
Really?
His first acting credit is in 1976's Jesus Bugsy Christ. Malone.
Yep. Yeah.
That gangster movie with all the kids. When I started tripping back through there's like 84 pictures on IMDb and a lot of his various roles. Every single role, I instantly knew who he was in all those movies. I'm like, holy crap. I've been looking at this guy for 20 years and had no idea who he was. Taking a deep
dive into Dean Devlin. Right, and you find out the weird movies that he was in before he Dean Devlin.
Exactly. Dean Devlin. Oh, so Stephen McIntosh, dad, starred with Dexter Fletcher in Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels.
Yeah, that guy's around a lot too.
Which was produced by Matthew Vaughn.
Who directed it? Guy Ritchie.
That's Guy Ritchie's first film.
Yeah, that's a crazy film.
Yep. So Richard Madden, or
Rob Stark,
as we like to call him, Rob Stark. Played John Reed, Elton John's manager.
And Dick.
One-time lover. So in Bohemian Rhapsody, John Reed is played by Aidan Gillen.
That's weird.
Who is Littlefinger from Game of Thrones.
Wow.
But it was the same, it's the same character, it's the same guy.
Yeah, but it's weird because he's more sympathetic in Bohemian Rhapsody. He comes off as more of a...
Yes.
More of an even keel. Like, he's more on the band side in that iteration of him.
And he's much more just straightforward.
Yeah.
There's nothing hinky going on.
No.
They both get stabbed and killed on Game of Thrones, too. So maybe that's why they both got that role. Did I spoil something for you, viewers? I'm sorry. If you don't watch Game of Thrones by now.
Lathan's in the mood tonight. Yeah.
So the screenplay for this film was written by Lee Hall, who also wrote Billy Elliot, a movie called War Horse.
The Spielberg movie?
Yeah.
Mm, that's a good movie.
And he wrote the screenplay for Cats.
Uh-oh. Oh. Someone's got a graph downturn.
That's too bad.
But this was the most interesting part of Lee Hall that I found in my little dive. So if you look at him on IMDb, he has a film listed from 2011. Called Hippie Hippie Shake. And you know how they put up the little thing next to it that says like pre-production, post-production, you know, announced, and it's usually in red next to the title for new projects. So next to this one, it says abandoned. And I've never seen that before on IMDb. So I did a little digging, and apparently back in 2005, they shot this film called Hippie Hippie Shake. It was a Universal film. The director hadn't done a lot. I can't remember her name. But they film the whole thing, and somewhere in 2007, the director and Lee Hall both quit during the editing process for unknown reasons.
Always a good sign. Always a good sign.
So in 2011, which this movie is still just sitting in the can, Green Zone, the Matt Damon Gulf War movie, completely tanks for Universal. So Universal wrote off Hippie Hippie Shake for the insurance and destroyed all the negatives.
Wow.
So for all intents and purposes, this movie just doesn't exist anymore. But that's fucking crazy. They filmed the whole thing and it got to the editing process. And then they just decide, we're going to make a more off of this movie if we just junk it.
Imagine if it's your creative project too. Like, we've all done creative projects. Right. And someone just decides, right, I'm destroying your art so we get our insurance money. I mean, that's rough. That's rough.
If you look up the cast on this movie, it's legit. It had Cillian Murphy. It was the real deal.
Yeah.
It wasn't just some little indie film.
Right.
I'd never seen anything like that before. And I'm sure it's happened more times than any of us know.
Yeah.
But I just thought that was crazy.
I forget the name of it, of course, because I'm terrible with names and everything else. But they said it's actually a miracle that any film gets finished in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Like, any project actually sees completion. Basically talking about, there are so many pitfalls, there are so many obstacles, there are so many people working at cross purposes and people trying to take advantage and people in the business for exactly the wrong reasons or whatever, that the fact that any film actually makes it to a theater where it could be judged as a legitimate piece of art for people to enjoy is a miracle.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think there's probably so many points along the curve that the studio can look at a project and go, and just in a case like this, it's like, we're this far into it, but is it worth more to us if we just threw it away?
And then they start going,
do we really think this movie's going to make $100 million? Or is this movie going to make $30 million on a $50 million budget?
Yeah, it just becomes a business thing.
Unless you have a real power broker behind the film, either in the producer side or on the, the acting side, who can just be like, we can't junk this movie. It's got fucking Tom Cruise in it, something along those lines.
Yeah. I mean, you can junk Cillian Murphy. You can't junk Tom Cruise.
Yeah. So the 70s footage in the scene where they go to the Troubadour, shots of L.A., was old stock footage, old 35mm stock footage that they digitally cleaned up.
That's really cool. I thought about that when that was on screen.
Yeah, I took a point to notice that this time around.
I'm going to check that out again.
So this film had 64 award nominations and 21 wins, including the Oscar for Best Original Song.
Which song?
It's the song that they wrote for the film. It's the one new song that's in the movie. It's the song that they wrote for it.
Yeah.
But it's the first time that Bernie Taupin got an Oscar.
Yeah.
Because the previous Elton John stuff was just him.
Yeah.
As is typical, and I've gone over this before, but even more so when you do a film that's either based on a true story or, in this case, based on someone who's still alive and whose life is, for all intents and purposes, an open book. Lots of nitpicking on this film online, all different sources. Oh, what's right? What's wrong? What's true? What's not? And I find it interesting because from the beginning, Elton John said that the kind of film that he wanted made of his life was not the kind of film we got for Bohemian Rhapsody. He wanted it to reflect what he felt was the fantastical sort of life that he'd been lucky enough to survive to get where he is today. And I think that's exactly what he got. I think Dexter Fletcher delivered that in every possible aspect.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I would agree.
The musical sequences are filtered right into the story. I mean, I don't know how you can debate factual parts of this when those scenes are integrated into the whole story.
Well, it was like, oh, well, this song hadn't even been written yet. And, the car they show up at the Troubadour wasn't going to be built for another 2 years and shit like that. It's just like the shit people go on about. And it's like, you know, if you took time to look at the poster when you walked in, you know, it says based on a true fantasy.
Yeah, exactly. That's
it. What more do you want? Look at any other quote unquote rock star from the same era as Elton John. Can you put anyone at his level when it comes to showmanship and theatricality?
Not an individual, maybe a group. I don't know. Maybe Kiss. I don't know. I mean, not an individual. No, and maybe Bowie in certain circumstances.
Yeah, yeah.
Not in the context of which he was.
Yeah, no, how he was performing with the musical instrument. Yeah, no one compared.
Suitably impressed upon by this film. I liked it a lot, especially coming on the heels of Bohemian Rhapsody, kind of the way it did, and with the Dexter Fletcher connection. I thought it was an interesting yin and yang of two parts of rock history.
Right.
You know, I think shown together, they make a very interesting double feature.
That's kind of the thing I was talking to you about before, about, you know, people complaining about the car, the make of the car, whatever the song was written, because of the way the film is stylized. It literally doesn't matter. You've literally missed the point if you're checking the make and model of cars, you know? Whereas if you look at, say, Bohemian Rhapsody, the fact that he, you know, like just some details, like he knew he had AIDS before the Live Aid show, the famous, which he didn't, you know, and it would be years later that he got really, you know, that they, you know, so I mean, the way they bend the truth in Bohemian Rhapsody is almost a little more egregious, because they didn't have to set it up to be, you know, to try to use moments for it to be climactic. The story in and of itself is climactic. So if you're, you know, when you're telling stories in that kind of linear fashion, you do have to pay attention to certain details, or why are you doing it? Whereas with Rocketman, if it is kind of a true story with a wink and a nod, then, you know, it could take liberties with stuff like that, know, with him singing songs that he hadn't written in 40 years when he was a kid, you
it's
know?
Right.
I mean, his mom and his dad were singing, for God's sake. I mean, how truthful were people, you know, like, what were people looking for while they were watching that?
You don't That's know ridiculous. Enough about film if you're picking on that in this movie. So
yeah, right. You're just looking for something to say.
You're trying to be relevant and missing the whole thematic point of the film. So
right.
Absolutely.
And you know, it's funny, I watching this again and having now seen enough filmed versions of musical stage plays like Mamma Mia.
Yeah.
You know, movies along those lines. This movie feels very much like you could almost take this and go right the other way and make a stage play out of it.
You could.
I think it'd definitely be pricey, obviously, but I think you could definitely make a big Broadway production out of this.
I think that's
just the licensing alone of all those songs would cripple any publishing company.
Well, I mean, obviously Elton John would be involved, so I mean, that would come as part of the package. So
one would hope if he wouldn't rake them over the coals for it.
Listen,
there's a lot of intellectual property.
If he is right, but if he's writing the book on the play,
he's got it.
You're getting that as part of the package.
I don't disagree.
Right. He would have to be involved or it's pointless.
Yes. Yeah.
In some capacity.
I guess we can go.
How much did it make at the box office? Do you know? I remember it didn't make the splash that Bohemian Rhapsody did. It came out right after it. Kind of bad timing.
A year later. Right? No, you're right.
According to Box Office Mojo, for Bohemian Rhapsody, it says 903 is worldwide.
Yeah, I was going to say, that'd be really difficult to make U.S.
It's 216 domestic.
Okay, that's still
a good haul. So it's 17 million, or 20 million more than Rocketman.
It's the most successful music biopic of all time, if I'm not mistaken. Bohemian
Rhapsody. I wouldn't doubt it, yeah.
Bohemian Rhapsody?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, yeah.
And international was 687, so yeah, it had a $50 million opening weekend.
Yeah, so it's a success. Both the movies are successes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just got outshined by Bohemian, exactly, because that was such a runaway.
Was Bohemian Rhapsody last year?
It's kind of sad. It was another. Was another sad experience.
And no, dude, Rami that was Malik a year was ago. Fantastic.
It was the November before. It was 18. Yeah,
Bohemian Rhapsody was 2018. Yeah. This was 2019. Yes. They're a year apart.
Correct.
I was gonna say because I saw that in the theater. So,
Rocketman's box office is 195 worldwide. Its domestic was 96 and international 98.
Yeah, it's still a winner with a $40 million budget. So,
oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. It's still a winner anyway.
You're still a winner in my book.
Everyone gets a trophy. All right, we better head down the tubes.
Cynics.
Sinner.
I like my trophies. Thank you.
No martini for this one because the guy doesn't have a lot of movies or what's
martinis that? After the tubes.
Oh, it is?
Every week with you.
Oh, wait a minute. It's the first thing we do?
Let's go down the tubes.
And again, the internet is not something that you just dump something on. It's not a big truck. It's a series of tubes.
We need a theme for that.
Alrighty. Once again with this film, there's four main advance images, two or three of which became really the main images for all the posters. Doesn't matter what country you go to, they just change the wording into the local language. There wasn't a lot of variety with the poster campaign for this film. We get the one, the really advanced poster of him with his foot up on the piano in the White Angel outfit. And then you have the shot of him at the piano at Dodger Stadium. This one was for Dolby Cinemas. Was the close-up of Taron with the space in the background of the glasses. Yeah. And then this other shot of him from the back in this Dodger Stadium event. There are those two shots from Dodger Stadium. Those were really the two big poster images they used worldwide.
They're all colorful and work, I think, all four of them.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you need a whole lot of, you know, the poster's not going to sell this movie. Everyone knows who Elton John is. You don't have to tell the world who he is. Everyone knows who he is already. You just have to know that the movie is about Elton John.
It's almost more interesting to look at the poster and see who have they got to play him.
Yes. Yes, I agree. Yeah, surprisingly, there weren't a ton of alt posters for this. I ended up finding a handful. All right, so
first one I got is Inio Asano.
So yeah, I found the manga website Crunchyroll had an article about manga creators doing their versions of Elton John for the film, like the promotional images for Rocketman. So there are two in here. This is the first one. Well-known manga artist, which means I have no idea who they are. Because it's just not my world, unfortunately. But
it's colorful, but it's not really.
No. I mean, there's very few of those. There's a lot of more images that sort of reflect. I mean, this next one by a guy goes by the name of Kermit. His Tumblr is under the name Hedger Logs. But I actually kind of like this. The stripes, and each stripe is a different version of Elton. That's a neat idea. Cool. Well executed. The next image is by a Ukrainian artist whose work I absolutely love. She's been working with us at Printed in Blood from the very beginning, from the Thing book. She always does a piece for our projects. And I really like her work in general. So she had just posted this up as a tribute piece. So I put it in here. I like Lisa Shymskaya's stuff a lot. So
yeah, that's
a nice, it'd be a nice print, you know,
And I would know Elton John from the glasses and the piano, you know, like without knowing anything about it, I would know exactly who this is for.
This would be a great poster if you just, you know, somehow accentuated the lyric Rocket Man somehow. I like this one a lot.
And then, so next we have Miriam Al Madama. And then I like the design aspect of this. This is, it's fun, but it's actually interesting because it looks more like the artist actually drew Elton John and not Taron. It looks a little bit more like Elton than it actually does Taron playing Elton.
I like the trick where the moon is the helmet.
That's fine. I think that's just the whole design aspect of it I like. And it's a neat little image. The rainbow orbits. And the next one is by an artist named Nate Gonzalez. He goes by The Dark Nate Returns, which I find him infinitely amusing. He did a couple of pieces. The other one he did was a little less interesting than this one. I really like the way this one kind of came out. All just little vignettes of the characters in different parts of the movie.
Yeah.
He did a lot for what this image is. He put a lot of work into it for sure. This was a poster obviously for performance.
That's cool.
With Elton and Taryn at the Greek, which would have been amazing to be in attendance at. Yeah.
So he can play the piano fully.
Who? Taryn? I don't think he can play to the extent of actually playing Elton John songs.
Yeah.
But because every time I've ever seen him perform with Elton John, he's only sung. I mean, obviously he's not going to jump on the piano with Elton John on stage with him, clearly, but.
Yeah, you don't want to do that. You don't want to strap on a guitar right next to Eddie Van Halen. You don't want to really do.
Well, here it all. Let me show you how I learned today.
Yeah, that's nice.
That's nice.
he barely knows how to play the piano.
I did just to take us back for a minute. The scene where he gets his lesson.
Oh yeah,
he's auditioning, and I loved. When he was playing and he stopped playing.
She's like, why'd you stop?
And the minute, he's like, because that's where you left off.
That's where you stopped. That's all I heard.
Yeah, that was great. That was great.
And then, and her acting was brilliant because she was like, oh my God, you know, but he played it really cool, like as an instructor.
Well, that was the great thing. That's what I loved about that scene is the instructor was like, clearly she knew what she had in front of her.
Yeah.
But she's like, it takes more than that.
Right.
She's like, but for her to recognize instantly, she's like, you may have a good ear.
Yeah, but but you got a lot of work to do.
We're starting with scales.
But I like that the audition was over right after, you know, it was.
That was it.
It's like, all right. And not only that, the audition ended and they went right into their first lesson. Like she's just, all right, you got an hour. We're going to go through some scales. Fantastic.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So then the final image here is by Yuki Kodama, the other, and this is obviously much more manga looking.
Yeah, it is.
But, you know, if they were doing an adapt,
you know, like they.
Yes. Yeah. Like that was, you know, they decided to do.
Right on the
Seu Rakuman.
Right on the shelf next to Akira.
Super Rakuman.
Yeah.
Who is Yuga the Rakuman?
We're going to get bad. We're going to get negative mail about that one.
It's going to be bad.
I'll have to edit that out. And then finally, you notice that there's a movie poster on here for the film Rocketman. The other Rocketman.
I did not know that.
Oh, you know what? I don't think I included it. Never mind.
Darn it. Don't tease.
Rocketman. You have great ideas and you don't share.
I know.
We're going to watch The Rocketeer next, right? We're just going to do a rocket motif up until. Although that's not.
And then we'll watch Bottle Rocket. Wes Anderson's first film.
Yep. And I am out of rocket movies after that one.
We'll watch Sucker Punch because there's a character named Rocket in it. And then we'll watch Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
Starting Rocket, right? Yeah. So moving on to what would normally be the martini, where we would discuss this director's body of work, which is
that of a midget,
very small. His first film, directed in 2011, was a small British kind of I don't want to say gangster film, but crime dependent or about a criminal getting out of jail and trying to go right, called Wild Bill, starring the guy who played the assistant to Ian Holm in Fifth Element.
Oh, that kid. Mm. Okay.
Yes, he plays the lead.
I thought he was going to kill me.
Yeah. So his second film was an adaptation of the stage play Sunshine on Leith, which is based around the songs of the Proclaimers.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
Which I watched this afternoon along with his third film, Eddie the Eagle.
I'm supposed to watch stuff without telling us you're going to watch stuff. We didn't do our homework.
You watched Eddie the Eagle?
I did.
Before or after Phantasm?
I watched Eddie the Eagle and Sunshine on Leith this afternoon. I watched Phantasm while we were eating dinner.
Yeah.
Okay. How was Eddie the
Eagle? Eddie the Eagle was... the man is an adept director. I will tell you hands down that both of those films were both enjoyable to watch.
Okay.
Eddie the Eagle was a lot of fun. I had no idea that Hugh Jackman was in it.
Oh, does he play Wolverine?
He does not. He plays an ex-ski jumper.
Okay.
The movie's about ski jumping. It's, you know, goes hand in hand. Yeah, it's the Dexter Fletcher is a very good director. I have not watched Wild Bill yet. I have it. I assume in his hands that Sherlock Holmes 3 will be at least as entertaining as 2, if it doesn't match 1.
I didn't find 2 as entertaining as the first one.
Me neither. I thought it was, it's a case of one of those things where it's like, if you like the first one, you're going to like the second one. It's just kind of a more of the same kind of thing, but it's definitely not as original as the first
one. It seemed like the second one was trying too hard. That's the criticism I would give it. I enjoy it, and I enjoy the two of them, but something was a little, I don't know, slightly tonally off about it.
I felt like they were trying to jam too much story into
probably.
It. I think they're trying to just jam a little too much stuff into it.
I mean, Jared Harris as Moriarty, you can't go wrong with that. But
right.
One funny aspect of it that you will not know unless you've been watching it on social media, that they went back and instilled Jared Harris's voice in Moriarty in part one. Because they don't show his face, if you remember. They don't show Moriarty's face. Right. So they went back and Jared Harris dubbed his voice in all those weird scenes where you only see his gloves and a top hat.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
That's why I held on because I got a steelbook version of the first movie and I almost got rid of my original copy. I almost gave it away. But then that's the only, it eventually, very quickly, that'll be the only, one of the very few left around versions, with the original, right? Yeah, the original version of it.
Ah, very cool. I did not know that.
That's very Hayden Christensen Force Ghost like.
Yes. But much less invasive.
Yes.
And much more okay.
Kind of had to do that when they changed the timeline.
Yeah.
Because of 20 years, like what? Even you go from Ewan McGregor to Alec Guinness. It's just like, wow, life is hard on Tatooine in only 20 years.
Yeah. Jedi drinking stories at the cantina.
It's all that goddamn blue milk.
Yeah. Some kind of great drink you can make with blue milk and Bantha poodoo.
Oh, no. Stop.
Bantha poodoo. Me solo chung wookie.
Please let's get off this topic.
Yeah.
Don't
worry, we'll never do a Star Wars movie.
It's using the old Jedi mind trick.
Yeah.
My favorite scene in any movie ever is the scene that is actually referred to as the Return of the Jedi. Where at the Sarlacc pit.
That's one of mine too.
When he jumps from the one skiff to the other skiff while under fire, I remember being a kid going, "Oh, all right." So Luke's the new hero now, you know. Luke's my new favorite person. I got you.
There is another.
That scene was amazing in the theater in 1983 because you were like, "How are they getting out of this?"
You watch it now. The saddest human being in cinematic history is the guy, is the deck gunner on the sail barge.
Oh, he's awful.
Because he's firing, he's doing his job, firing away, you know, trying to kill Han and Chewie or whatever. And there's this kid with this green stick comes out of nowhere and murders him. If you watch that scene, he kind of glances over and has no time whatsoever to process what's about to happen to him.
Oh yeah, he's in hell.
Yeah, he was in the afterlife before he realized he got killed.
Help me, I am in hell. So, I have. So that, neither of you have seen out. Any of Dexter Fletcher's other three.
No,
films.
I haven't seen any of his other movies, but I would definitely see another one of his.
Yeah,
movies.
Eddie the Eagle and Sunshine on Leith are both definitely worth watching. Sunshine on Leith is it's very clearly an adaptation of a musical. I mean, it's very much, you know, people bust out into song, scene after scene. It's, you know, it's very much along the lines of Mamma Mia.
Okay.
Feels, yeah. So but if you know, if you're a fan of the Proclaimers and you know their work, the movie's a lot of fun. How they build everything up around so many of their songs, and it basically tells a story of three relationships. You know, a couple that's been married for 25 years, that follows two friends when they come back from the war, and one of them has been dating the other one's sister before he left. So that's a relationship that's already in existence. And then the third character is at the start of a brand new relationship. So it's like an evolution of three different relationships that are sort of all happening at the same time, and how they just sort of deal with it coming home from the war and, you know, that kind of thing. But very nicely handled. Lots of a couple of big song and dance numbers out in public, very similar to Saturday Night's All Right with Fighting, but even a little bigger. But that very, very deftly handled, you know, very clearly shown that he was capable of pulling this off. Had I seen this stuff ahead of time and known, there definitely would have been no doubt. So,
yeah, but very, it's a nice little surprise the way, you know, when you find out this way, right? You go see a movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, to be able to see this and kind of look back and go, wow, if I'd have seen this four or 5 years ago, and known this was the same guy, I maybe not necessarily still would have been expecting what I got.
Right.
But I definitely would have been more
confident you were going to get something pretty decent.
Yeah. Not that I wasn't literally from the first trailer of Rocket Man, I, you know, you knew what you were getting, and it was, you know, you just hoped it was going to be good. And it was, as far as I'm concerned. So, and that is Rocket Man. If you haven't seen it, which I would find hard to believe, I would say go see it, because it's pretty good. So, if you guys have nothing else, no, yes,
no.
That was a
nothing fun ride.
So, thanks to Purple Planet Music, lots of great, amazing music is available at purple-planet.com. Please check out our website, cinementalpod.com, for all the poster images we discuss on our Down the Tube segments, and don't forget to download and subscribe to Cinemental wherever you enjoy your podcasts. You can always listen to new episodes weekly at cinementalpod.com. Also, you can follow us on all major social media accounts at cinementalpod. Thank you very much, guys. Hassan, Latham Conger, and as always, in the words of our most excellent benefactor, Truman Burbank.
Good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
Out. And we're out.
Record time.
Yeah, I thought this one would probably go quick. I knew we were going to be short up front with the...
stop recording.
With the news. No. Because this is where you get the good stuff.
No. I don't want to say... Yeah. I have terrible things to say about everybody I know. And I
Oh, okay. Hang on then.